What we're going to do is be off on a very rapid discussion of dealing with borderline problems, starting with the source of them, and then using the basically an analysis of what goes wrong in the from a brain level to say, here's what needs to be done to repair that from a brain level. Now, if we were going to spend a week or two going over this material, and most of us could really do that, we would begin to weave in all of the other components that you've been hearing about in this conference, like where does intercession come in, where does deliverance come in, where does the Christian community come in. There's a lot of other aspects that are simply not going to be in this discussion, because for an hour and 5 minutes that we have here, we're going to talk about what does this actually have to do with what's going on in the brain. That's the part that most of us are not particularly familiar with, that some of the problems that we're dealing with, we're trying to help, we're actually trying to help people grow a part of their brain that either never grew or grew incorrectly. And actually, a part that grew incorrectly is worse to deal with than the ones that didn't really grow at all. Because if it didn't grow, you can at least, when it whatever grows is hopefully growing the right way. But if someone's actually got warped something in there, trying to get that to stop while you put in something new is like twice as much trouble. And that's really what you have when you're dealing with borderline problems. By and large, you're trying to overcome a defective brain while trying to grow something that's strong enough to deal with that and live life correctly. Well, one thing that ought to be real clear to all of us at that point is that nothing physical grows that fast. It isn't like you can just say one time to somebody, be healed, and they've grown the whatever it is. And again, people often ask me, well, can't God just miraculously heal the brain? And I say that's true. However, I I've seen a lot of people. I have some friends that have lost a hand or an arm, and it's quite true that God could miraculously grow them a new hand or an arm. I've yet to see it, which may be my lack of faith, or it might just be the way that God works, you see. But just because he could doesn't mean that when it comes to brains, we should suddenly decide that God's going to deal with this part of our body differently than he would hands or arms, because those are kind of convenient to have too. So we have people who we're dealing with really basically have a physical deficit that we're helping them to overcome. And when we approach it from that point of view, it helps us to demystify, despiritualize some of the things that we like to make spiritual. Just because it's about our personality doesn't necessarily automatically make it a spiritual issue. However, I would add that just because there's a physical problem doesn't automatically make it not a spiritual issue either. Because, as all of us probably know by now, the enemy loves to attack in the areas where we have weaknesses and problems. So where would we expect him to show up more frequently than when there's a problem in the brain? That ought to be one of his favorite places to hang around. Okay? So what I'm saying, though, is I'm not going to discuss how that goes together in the brief time we have here. At the beginning of your notes, you will find a narrative section on bonding and the treatment of borderline problems. It runs about a page. That's the review of the background that we covered on Thursday. And so if you weren't here on Thursday, you might want to look at that. We're also going to go over that a little bit in the next hour, along with how to live with your heart and return to joy. So if you missed that, that's a chance to review it. What we're going to talk about today is restoring the missing joy strength and return to joy circuits through joy-bonded relationships, and how nonverbal right hemispheric communication works to establish emotional control and identity, how the counselor finds joy in helping borderline people, and when we start from the basis of our nervous system, we help them by establishing joy, which means we're glad to be together. So, let's stop and pray here a second. Lord God, we are about to embark into how to be glad to be with the people who are decidedly, from psychological point of view, the hardest to be with. We want to do that in your presence. And, somehow when we're in the middle of trouble, being glad to be with you and glad to be with the church. trouble altogether is hard to maintain too. So we ask that you would help us to stay focused on who you are in the middle of our troubles so that we might lead others to joy as well. And we pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen. All right. First of all, a little distinction here between borderline and dissociative disorders. And since we're dealing with counselors, I'm not going to really define that. I'm just going to tell you what's different about the... Oh, good, we have sound. Oh, hallelujah. Yes. Yes, borderline and dissociation both have their origin in both A and B type traumas. And A type traumas are the absence of the necessary good things in life. And what that really produces is a weakness that is easily broken. It's like having very, very weak bones. I remember when I was a kid in Colombia, we had one kid that was running across the playground. He fell down, and his arm actually ended up in the shape of a Z. He didn't actually break a bone because his calcium level was so low that his bones had just folded up like an accordion. The absence of the necessary calcium is a type A trauma. The falling in the playground is a type B trauma. It's a bad thing that happens. So a bad thing that happens to his arm actually just collapsed it like an accordion. And so they had to stretch it out. But, you know, this is what it looks like when you have these two things together. If I'd fallen in the playground, there would have been a no event because my parents gave me plenty of milk and calcium, and so I would have just fallen down and picked myself up and gone on. But you can see how these two things work together. So basically, it's a self that doesn't make sense in half, whereas all the attachment happens from about 3 months of age up till about 18 months of age. So we can see we're heading very much earlier in the life of the child. We're dealing with borderline. We're talking about 3 to 18 months is the primary problem, whereas dissociative disorder, we're talking about 2.5 years and on, but particularly around 2.5 years as being the main problem. Now, both can disrupt the right and left hemispheric memories. In other words, if you have trauma at any point in time, you can have a trauma that's stored in right hemispheric memory but not in left hemispheric memory. And the disruption of those two things makes a brain that's incoherent. The left and right hemispheres cannot line up and figure out what to do with this information because one or the other of them doesn't have it. And so you can't make sense of the world while one half of your brain says, I know it, and the other says, I don't. You know, one half says it's true, the other says it isn't. That just makes life very confusing. And both disorders do that. So part of recovering from those traumas is dealing with how to deal with implicit memories that have no explicit record. And we went over that in the second session on Thursday. Okay, so what are the necessary skills for a functioning personality? This is the essence of the lecture right here. There's 7 of them. You're going to have trouble. And then borderline, typically, if you go down to line C, all 7 are messed up. So you may end up having to help a person correct all 7 problems. But let's look at the 7 problems individually. The first is a secure attachment. So you know who you belong to, where you're attached to in the world, and you know what older brain you are modeling after. So you know, basically you have a goal and a map that you're following. That's a secure attachment. The second is sufficient joy strength to resolve loss. So you've grown enough of a joyful identity so that if anything goes wrong, you can take care of it. The third is emotional regulation. You have learned how to regulate your own emotions in 2 ways. You can do it together with another person, mutual regulation, which you do with the large and overwhelming things. For example, right now, we anticipate Dr. Kraft's father died overnight from the call I had last night, and his family is going to be mutually regulating their sense of loss. They're all gathered together. They're sharing this emotion. It's too much for anyone to carry by themselves, but all together, they're going to try to handle this. And it'll be too much for their family, so their church and others will be gathering around them, and their friends will be coming in, and they will be trying to carry this sense of loss. Mutual regulation. We're handling this feeling together. And then individual regulation is those things that are within my capacity. I can handle that myself. I can soothe myself. I can say I can get over this feeling. So if you make me mad, I can get back to being regulated and calm and in a secure state. That's self-regulation. So those two skills need to be learned. The fourth thing is the return to joy circuits have to be in place so that no matter what feeling you have, you know how to return to joy and be glad with other people. In other words, you are a relational human being no matter what you feel, and you will do the same thing in relationship regardless of whatever feeling you're in. You know how to be glad to be with someone else when you're mad, when you're afraid, when you're sad, when you're hurt, when you're angry, when you're humiliated, when you feel hopeless, and when you feel embarrassed. And for me, one of the hardest ones, like if you feel betrayed. And how do you know, go about being glad to be with other people? Now, if you wonder about those things, is it possible? Just go to Jesus, his last night on earth, out through the crucifixion, and you'll find somebody who, in the middle of all of these things going wrong, is in fact practicing, I am glad to be with you. And what does he say about the Last Supper when he's there with the person who's about to betray him? He says, with lust I have lusted to have this meal with you. And that's the same word for lust used if a man lusts after a woman in his own heart. You know, he's already committed adultery. It's an intense desire, and Jesus uses it twice to make it even more intense, with extremely intense desire, with a passionate desire, with I have wanted to be with you. This is intense joy. I have intense joy to be with you, even though you're going to betray me, even though you're going to run away from me. All these, this is possible, because this is our example of what a human being would be like if they were operating in the full presence and experience of God. That's where we're headed. So we know it's possible in person, not just in theory. But we have to grow our way there, don't we? All right, then you have to have a limbic system control. And the limbic system is the four Fs, if you remember right. Fear, fighting, feeding, and sexual reproduction, or sexual drive. And fornication is the word that the original doctor who used the came up with the limbic system used, so he came up with his four Fs. The ability to control those brain drive centers is essential if you're going to lead a well-regulated life. Number center that basically interprets what is going on in someone else's mind. So you look at them, you know what they're thinking. It's called mind sight also. So I'm able to look at you and know what you're thinking in some way. And to have an accurate one is extremely essential if you're going to deal with relationships. Missing interpreter, missing mind sight is one of the leading characteristics of autism. They look at another person and they don't see a person there. They just react to whatever's happening, but they can't put it together that there's a person inside the face that they're interacting with. And the final one is the ability to repair ruptures in relationships. That is, when your relationship with someone else breaks apart and just goes completely haywire, you have to be able to put that back together again. And people with borderline problems don't know how to do that. And in fact, lots of people in church don't know how to do that. We live in a very borderline-ish sort of society. Now, one of the clear ways of just describing borderline is that instead of acting like yourself, you try to live according to a role and say, I'll play this role and you play that role. And so we find that the majority of counselors are rather borderline because they approach their whole concept of boundaries and how to deal with others by, I'm going to play this role and you're going to play that role. And if you get out of the role that I'm in, then it's over. We've got to rupture our relationship and that's the end of it. Most pastors have experienced something like this from a borderline-ish sort of parishioner that says, you're the pastor and I'm the parishioner, and so it doesn't matter, it's 3 a.m. in the morning, I call you, you're supposed to do pastor-like things, and if not, I'll be angry at you and I'll punish you. And you may have even found some of this on your board, or elder board, or whatever it is. You know, you're going to be the pastor and I'm going to be the this, and if you get out of line of what a pastor ought to do, then you're going to get hammered for it. That's the borderline kind of response. The virtual other, the interpreter, is not looking at you as a person. They've just categorized you as a role and say, you're going to act like this, and that's all that will be permitted in order to make life live. Well, one of the things that we have to do if we're going to deal with borderlines is we have to get the borderline kind of tendencies out of ourselves. So you're going to find that Jesus, in fact, never did live into any roles. He always acted genuinely like himself in relationship to the God the Father and with others at the same time. In the middle of that, there's an enormous freedom to go about acting like who God created you to be in that moment. That is the direction. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why God so blesses us to bring borderline people into our own lives. And that is, if you have any tendencies that way, if you're going to help this person, you're going to have them eliminated from yourself. A way to live. It really is just amazing that these folks can actually live and function at all. If you are that badly wired, the wonder is that you could show your face in public again. And even more of a wonder that you'd go to anybody at all and say, I really want you to help me with all of this. This is just a wonder. And so I as I began to understand what they're working with, I began to discover that it's an enormous honor to have somebody like that select me as someone. And it's even more of an honor, if I think about it, that wasn't just them, but I think God's Holy Spirit was guiding this person to me and say, I really want you to be a part of correcting this. Now, as Ed reminded me, the statistics on borderline personality is that in order to recover, you have to have had one meaningful attachment in childhood, and you have to go through 6 therapists. And you burn out the first 5. You just, things blow up, and that's the end of things. So you might be blessed to be part of this process, and you might be one of the first 5. You know, the relationship may end in a disaster, but nonetheless, you're part of the process. Just because you couldn't repair everything that went wrong didn't mean that God didn't grow something through you. So we're part of a process that may involve a whole community of people. You may be just a part of it. So let's again be humble before God and say, let's see what part of this he brought me to. We'll take it as far as we can, but it's also not up to us to get results. As soon as we're trying to get results, we're back to acting borderline ourselves. I'm here to do this so that you'll do that, and you'll be in this role, and I'll do this, and then we'll all make it work out. You know, relationships in the kingdom of God is not about making everything work out. It's about being the person God created us to be and watching what he's doing in the midst of that. It's his making it all work out. So that's the big, huge relief that lets us go in and fail repeatedly on these tasks. Well, and in essence, with borderlines, when you get down to the ability to repair ruptures, the real work starts after everything went wrong. Because it's only when you finally learn how to get back together, after they've betrayed you 3 times, how do you fix them breakfast? Some of you are realizing that Jesus was fixing breakfast for Peter after being betrayed. So put that all together right there. Because shame always wants to hide. It wants to disappear from the disapproving eyes that are looking at it. So if you see someone who, when they fall into shame, they just want to disappear, they want to go away, they want to hide, you realize that operates as a separate mood state. That's one of the characteristics that go with borderline kind of development. And so you will find that borderlines will frequently attack you when they feel humiliated, and what they will try to do to you is humiliate you you are going to be feeling this humiliation, make it stop. Now, humiliation is a combination of 2 of those 6 important emotions that we talked about as far as the preorbital frontal cortex goes. It's actually a parasympathetic one and a sympathetic one. And so it puts your body in the worst possible shape it could be in. On the one hand, it's rage. So you're as raging as you can be, and that puts as much adrenaline in your system, tries to turn everything on so that you charge and attack, and at the same time it's intense shame, so you're trying to shut everything in your body down at the same time and withdraw as hard as you can. So you have both of these things. It's like having the accelerator on your car and the brakes both jammed to the floor at the same time. That's humiliation as far as your nervous system is concerned. At sort of maximum level. And people are then trying to figure out in the middle of that, how do I become a relational person and be glad to be with someone else and learn how to return back to joy? That's the problem that they're bringing to you. And they're bringing it to you because they hope that your brain knows how to handle those feelings and show them the way back. And that's basically the total of what we're talking about. They will share with you what they're feeling hopefully you can handle this, and then you'll show them how to handle your way back. Now, if you don't know who you are in the presence of humiliation, what do you do? Well, you'll either get mad to resolve it one way, or you'll be ashamed and withdraw to resolve it the other way. And you'll say, oh, I'm not going to be around you anymore. So there's no return to joy in either one. So again, it's a real test of your nervous system to see how you're going to handle this. Hopelessness disconnects. Now, hopelessness is probably one of the central ones on this whole process, because it depends on place is around, because obviously infants have a sense of time earlier than that. Well, here's the answer to your question. Right on the underneath your eye is where the orbital prefrontal cortex is. And if you begin to work your way around that cortex out to the side, right here, you have what's called the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. It's another part of the prefrontal cortex, most likely attached to the bonding with the father, where the orbital frontal is most likely is the one where the bonding with the mother takes place. So part of our bonding structure is there. Right in between that, right in inside your temple, is a little part. And what hopefulness is involved in is feeling that although I'm distressed, help is on its way. And so it seems very important from the brain's perspective that help arrive in a timely fashion during those first 18 months of age. And they found that the attachment to the father is connected to this part of the brain. And when the attachment to the father is absent during the this 18 to 24 month or 28 month period of time, children develop sleep terrors that wake them up at night, nightmares and stuff like that. They are not anticipating that help is going to arrive in time. So they feel this hopeless terror that the problem will come upon me and help will not be on its way. This anticipation of help is the preparation to return to joy. Even though I am in hopeless despair, someone is on their way, so who I am when I'm in hopeless despair is someone waiting for the one who is coming. This is very close to the expression that we have in Christianity called Maranatha. Though I'm in hopeless despair, help is coming. Now, narcissism is largely ashamed. The only way to do it is to make sure I never feel ashamed. So I'm not going to pay attention to anything that might make me feel ashamed. Any people who might send me messages that there's something wrong with me, I am just going to be perfect. That way I'll never have to feel ashamed, and that way I will do just fine. And so narcissism grows out of this total blocking of anything possibly ever being wrong with me. I just have to be perfect. Otherwise, I could never get back from the shame that I might fall into. When combined with type B trauma, these state triggers high level of unrelated, and something bad actually does happen to you, it feels just overwhelmingly terrible, like you can never get things back together, because you don't have the capacity to regulate the feelings, to be hopeful that someone will come and help you, to know who you are in the middle of all of that trauma. It just floods you with the most painfully upsetting emotions you could possibly hold on to. In fact, you can't hold on to them because they're so much bigger than your joy bucket that they just spill everywhere, and all you can do is hope that somewhere, somehow, sometime you'll get out of this particular mess. But yet you're hopeless about even doing that, so you just run desperately from one thing to another hoping something will make it quit. And that's what you see in borderline behavior. It makes them so charming. Defenses are fully unregulated states. And so they start developing a plan. And all of their brain potential goes into this plan to keep from getting into these states. I remember the first time I went out to dinner with somebody who was really quite borderline. And we sat down to eat, and I asked them something about how their salad was. And they just went into a rage on me. And they said, I was feeling just fine until you went and said that. And now I'm just upset, and the whole meal is ruined. And they just went off on me, and just this awful, how could I do this to them? What kind of a person was I? They thought I was a therapist, and they thought I was a Christian, and they thought I was a caring person, and how could I ruin their meal for them? Well, they couldn't get out of that state, and they were now punishing me. They're trying to say, don't trigger me like that. You get me in that state, I can't get out of it. How could you possibly do that to me? That's what their whole strategy for living is about. It makes sense. There's no way to recover from these things. All you can do is make sure you don't do it. Imagine for yourself, you're carrying this large pile of your great-grandmother's china. You know, for some reason, you have to carry it through life delicately balanced, and people are coming along all the time bumping you and making you drop it and maybe lose the only precious things in your life. Like, this is the best relationship I've had so far. Now you're making it fall and drop, and it's going... Wouldn't you kind of be annoyed? Wouldn't you want to say, hey, don't bump me. Hey, don't, you know, hey, stay away. And this is the basic mental state of someone dealing with these emotions. It's a terrible way to live. When there's, and so they just fall from one emotional pit into the next. As soon as they crawl out, they're just into a different one. Again, awful way to live. Is any wonder that these people are highly interested in drugs and suicide? I mean, all of a sudden, just listening to it all, you're probably thinking to yourself, I'd be interested. And since these unregulated states can't do anything, but just because they can see what they're doing, they can't do a thing about it. So they have this terrible problem of having to be observers of themselves doing this with no brain capacity, no circuits linking it up so that the part of them that can watch it all could actually do anything about it. So the best they can do is watch what's happening. I remember one time when I was a kid, one of my lovable neighbor boys used to come over and grab my hand and start slapping my face back and forth with it. And he'd say, stop slapping yourself. That's a dumb thing to do. Why'd you keep slapping yourself? And I could just see him watch my hand slapping my face back and forth. But this big guy's slapping it back and forth, telling me, hey, don't be stupid. Don't slap your face like that. And this is a little bit like the experience the borderline has, watching their hand do something that they wish they could stop it, but they haven't the strength to actually pull it off. Something bigger than them, some that they're not connected to, is running that. Don't you like the way God just redeemed that particular experience for me right there? It's a great illustration. In other words, they have no dissociative, classic kind of way, symptoms. They can remember everything. What happens when they go from emotional state to emotional state is that they remember what happened. Oh yeah, I was really mad and I told you I was going to not have any more to do with you, or I was going to kill you and your dog and your wife. But that doesn't matter anymore. I'm not feeling that way. So, like, I remember it, but it doesn't matter. And I'm going, oh, it matters to me. I mean, you're just telling me you're going to. I was just mad, you know. But when they go back to mad, it's as though what they were just talking with you about just now, which was, oh, that's okay, and I like you, and you're the best person I ever met, and you're the hope and dream of my life. I said, well, what happened to me being the hope and dream of your life and the most wonderful person you ever met? Well, I remember that happening, but it doesn't matter now because you were a brrr, and so I'm going to kill you and your wife and dog. So the memory is there, but it simply makes no difference, has no significance. Okay, now attachment and borderline development. The attachment patterns, and this is research of Mary Ainsworth, Mary Main, Judith Solomon, and Daniel Siegel. Well, it's actually not his research, but his summary of it that I'm working off of. Helps us understand what happens during attachment. Now we're going back to the first problem. Remember the seven problems that you have to have, seven working things with a relationship, you have to have a working attachment. What develops during by forming a good, healthy attachment? There are four attachment patterns. There's really two large categories, secure and insecure. And of the insecure, there's three kinds. The next page, you find a description of the secure. And how does the attachment work? Well, in a secure attachment, you're able to come and go. So you're securely attached whether you're together or you're apart. When you're together, you know you're glad to be together, and it soothes you, and you feel real great, and then you can go on and explore and play in the world. And then when something goes wrong, you go back together. You know they're going to be there. It's secure. It soothes you. And then when you feel soothed, you go out and explore the world, and that's secure. You know that the home will always be there, and you carry it with you, and you remember it when you're away. The attachment circuit, and they can go on their way. It goes on and off as the child needs it. The interpreter, the virtual other, which develops through attachment, because it was modeled on somebody who was really alive, had all of their feelings and everything present. The interpreter inside is alive, because it's copying someone who was. It's active, which means that, it's accurate, which means that when that interpreter is looking at somebody, it modeled after somebody who, when they were looking at the baby, were actually pretty accurate. They could tell if the baby was sad or happy or cold or hot, and they could accurately interpret what was going on in that little mind. If the little baby had had too much, they knew to stop, and if they needed more, they knew to keep going. And so they were accurate in what was going on. And it was present. That is to say, they could track moment by moment. Remember, this tracking, as we'll see in a minute, goes 6 times per second. So they kind of kept up with the process.
We need to get wired again, huh? All right.
Is this on?
We're on?
Okay.
I feel like the Secret Service there. Wire on me. Okay.
And what that means by being present-oriented is that it has great boundaries for present and past. In other words, if it's tracking a feeling, the feeling is actually happening in the moment. It's not something from the past that's coming in. And then it knows how to repair. When something goes wrong, you make sure you don't overwhelm the other person with your feelings while you're trying to fix it. And you also account for all disruptions, so you're accurate. If what went wrong was between us was that we were angry at each other, when we come back together, we're going to deal with being angry at each other. We're not going to deal with just being afraid or just being something else or just, well, we'll, you know. It says, this is what went wrong. We're going to deal with specifically what went wrong and put that part back together. So that's what it means. It deals with all of the parts accurately. Now, in avoidant pattern, you have dismissive parents. And dismissive parents basically say that the child's experience or emotional internal events are not important. They're just can be ignored. So their connections are infrequent and unsoothing, and the child, in other words, they model that little mind sight, their little vision of what's going on in other people's minds, on someone's mind sight that said, I don't see anything going on with you, and if it is, it isn't important, so we can just dismiss it. So their little mind sight also says, I don't see anything going on with you, and if it is, it isn't important, and I can just dismiss that. I don't have to pay attention to it. And there are no repairs when things go wrong in a relationship because nothing happened anyway. Have you ever seen that in church or in a relationship? These attachment patterns are very prominent. They are, as psychological factors go, the most enduring psychological characteristic from across the lifespan. It remains more constant than your intelligence scores, any other testable aspect of the human mind. The attachment pattern is the most enduring fixed pattern of any characteristic that you have across your lifespan. So what you're establishing here is very important. It determines what you're going to be able to see in other people and how you're going to interact. The ambivalent one has distracted parents. And in those, the connections are unpredictable. With the mind that they're copying is that the other person is being disrupted by feelings that are coming from their own past. They're coming from other places. They're not coming from the child. My friend Gordon Dalby talks about the time that his child wanted ice cream, and Gordon just refused to get him any. And he just got upset and angry about it, and he just couldn't saw his child's demands as unreasonable. Finally, he thought to himself, his left hemisphere kicked in and said, you know, there's no reason why you can't get this kid ice cream. So he said, well, we'll go there and we'll share one. And so they bought a bowl, one little bowl, one little scoop of ice cream, and his child was about 3, and his dad are eating out of the same bowl, and his child finally gets mad. He says, Dad, get your own bowl of ice cream. And right then it occurred to him, I can't. My dad never would let me have a bowl of ice cream. And every time I asked him, he said no. He realized his interpreter was seeing his son the way his dad said. No demands for ice cream are accurate. I mean, this is how specific this little interpreter can get. And he was flooding things from the past that had nothing to do with the present moment or this child or that need. He was operating out of a faulty interpreter. And so he had to try to restructure that for his son. Fortunately, he could. And so we have, that's what I mean by too loud with messages from the past. And repair is overstimulating, too intense, and overwhelms the child for little ruptures. In other words, because the parent, if they do think something is wrong, they attribute what's wrong based on their own feelings, not on the child's feelings. So they will repair things with the child until the parent feels better. Not till the child feels better, based on the parent needs. So it's always a little too big, a little too loud, a little too intense, a little something other than the child.
And so you also realize when people are repairing things with you that they will yell and carry on with you until they feel better. And it really doesn't matter whether you feel better yet or not. The interpreter inside is only saying, well, you're as upset about this as I am. You're having whatever feelings that are coming into me from my past. Now, the disorganized one, the connections produced, yeah, the person that you're trying to attach to is the very one that's scaring you. This happens when the parents themselves are frightened or when they're frightening, which is usually means that they're angry. So a highly angry parent or one who's actually frightened or terrified are both disorganized and you don't know how to get close to them. The circuit then, in other words, the parent, when they do look back on themselves and say, oh my goodness, what I did. They're so ashamed of that, that instead of dealing with what they did and its effect on the child, they just act like nothing happened. So they did notice it, they did pay attention to it, but they just thought it was hopeless. There's no point in talking about that, it'll just upset us again, so let's not even go there. And so there's an awareness of the parents that something happened, but no attempt to repair it. Okay, let's look at these patterns in just a second here. Secure attachment is, of course, the most wonderful one to have. The avoidant one with dismissive parents is often looked at as kind of ideal, because nothing bothers these people. And although as children they tend to not be bothered by what's going on around, they are the most debilitated and disrupted as in adult relationships, because they can never see the other person as having a need that they can respond to. These are the children that do best when you put them in missionary boarding school, for instance, because they go there and they just adjust to it like there was no problem. And if you ask them later how their experience was, they said it was fine, nothing went wrong, it was a perfectly good experience, nothing happened. I didn't notice anything, there was no problems in here at all, it was a perfect experience for me, I liked the place, it was just wonderful. Let's go and talk about something else. But as adults, they have tremendous deficits because they can't see what's going on in other people's minds. They can't relate to the internal experience of somebody else. Now, since many of them actually had a working interpreter early on in life, what happens with some of them is that they become dissociative and they learn to shut off their interpreter under certain conditions. And it's really interesting to me, the conditions. If the person has white skin, they shut off the interpreter. But if the person is a third world person, they turn the interpreter back on. Here's a person that I can relate to. So they're able to relate in third culture situations, but not in when they're on aunties and uncles and white faces. These people, as far as they're concerned, don't see what's going on inside of you, which is the typical environment in boarding school. Anyway, that no one is seeing what's going on inside of you and it doesn't matter. So you have less pain if you shut it off. Now, however, if they have dismissive parents to begin with, so they already start out with dismissive circuits, these are the children who will never find a place to adjust in the world. They'll never understand what's going on with other people's minds, no matter where they go. And they're socially terribly impaired. The ones that have the ambivalent attachment, on the other hand, whose attachment lights are on all the time, are the ones that are devastated by going to boarding school, because they just cry and cry and cry until they crumble and disintegrate inside. And they can never figure out why they can't attach to somebody. And these are the ones that just don't function at all after that. They can no longer coherently deal with their emotions or the events. And for them, the cycle of being at school and being away is very much like the ambivalent attachment. That is, we'll get together and deal with you when the schedule permits and when it fits with the cycle of education, school, and furlough, and all those sorts of things. And during those times, we'll do everything we want to make us feel better as adults, and then we go away when we want to, and it doesn't matter whether your attachment needs have been taken care of or not. So we have a very large, distressed population here, and these are the ones that seem to, throughout their life, never have recovered from the experience. Now, you look at those sorts of things, you wonder, okay, how are you going to repair those kinds of ruptures? And how are we going to deal with them? Look at that. Because very often, the people who go into Christian service have disrupted attachment patterns as well. And so we begin to look at how these operate in different churches and even in different ministries. We will realize that churches have a characteristic attachment patterns and various cultural and ethnic groups. And it would do us some good to look at how we deal with that, because if our backgrounds have any of those patterns, we can find that we can have actually one attachment pattern with one person and a different one with another one. So you can actually have in one person an attachment pattern, a dismissive one with their father, an avoidant one with their mother, a disorganized one with Christian leaders, and to have all these kinds of patterns operating in one individual. Well, the thing that happens, of course, with borderline is that that is happening without the basic strength of a human being underneath. And so all of these things become overwhelming. So when are remedial bonds needed? Because without building joy, they're not going to have any strength with which to handle any of the other things that go on. When they have infant maturity, you have to build joy. And when their functioning is dropping, the more you counsel them, the worse they do, then you have to stop dealing with problems and start focusing on building joy. Build a feeling together. And the way that this is done is that you disengage back to how it's learned. What happens when you're climbing Joy Mountain, as you recall, is that the baby begins to climb Joy Mountain. They're looking face-to-face communication with the mother, right brain to right brain communication. They're feeling more and more joy until they reach the maximum level of joy. When after that, it immediately becomes overwhelming and painful. The baby looks away, and if the mother looks away right then and disengages, the baby is able to re-regulate and settle back down and go, okay, I feel okay, and now I want to re-engage and hook up again. So then the mother re-engages and hooks up again, and they go on building joy. The baby gets overwhelmed. They disconnect and till the baby settles back down, and then they re-engage, and they go climbing Joy Mountain again. It's a nice pattern. It goes back and forth hundreds of times per hour. And once you get it down, you have a real working sense of when to engage and disengage with somebody else. You're tracking their brain, and as soon as their brain starts to look a little overwhelmed, you back off. You look away. You slow down. What happens with borderlines? They have no sense of when to back off, slow down. They keep overwhelming you. And the worse you feel, the more they pound on you. And so this sense of how to disengage and re-engage is very important. That's a basic neurological skill that's not there. And the way you learn it is by practicing it a few hundred times or maybe a few thousand times with them. But the problem for most of us is when someone overwhelms us, we will disengage, but we don't re-engage quickly. And so when these people upset us, because what are we engaging in? We're not engaging usually in joy. We're not engaging in something upsetting. You know, they made us just so mad now that we can't think. Or, you know, they're talking so much about how they're going to cut themselves that we are now totally disgusted. We're overwhelmed with that or some other kind of feeling that we have to disconnect and then re-engage quickly. Sometimes you have to walk outside the room, you know, just check your head and re-engage. And then as soon as you settle back down, you remember, oh, I remember who I am and why I'm here. You go back, re-engage. You'll probably quickly get overwhelmed. But you begin to build the certainty that if we get overwhelmed, we disengage and we come back together. Now, the problem with that we'll get into in a moment, but that's the basic skill you're trying to build. If the problem is return to joy circuits, which is the joy in the presence of that feeling, and there, like I said, there can be quite a catalog of those. So it's a good idea to start with the least difficult. Whichever one they have the most progress with is the one that you might want to start working on the most, because that's the one that they can first learn how to regulate, and after that you can say, see, you can do it. We can do this, we can take on the next one. It builds hope for both them and is greater, and they can have enough strength to to handle these painful feelings. Mutual regulation of hopeless despair will take the longest because that'll be the last one you'll deal with. It's intense. Your time together or you're going on vacation, just as you're leaving is when hopeless despair gets triggered. So it's like, yeah, I was with you as long as I possibly could. Now I really got to go. And now all of a sudden, boom, hopeless despair is there, intense form, and you're out of time and resources. It's, you know, it's awful, which makes it hard to do. It triggers right at hemispheric memories of abandonment and despair. So that if they had ever been abandoned and were in despair before, which they were, then all of those memories come flooding back to them. And since they're right hemispheric memories, they're experienced as though they were happening right in the present, and they can't distinguish between the present and the past. Because their little interpreter, their little virtual other, can't tell past from present. It's intruding, it's pouring in. They think it's happening now, and they think you're doing it to them. You're making them feel this awful, and obviously since you're going away, you could not care about them at all because you're going to leave them in such an awful place. It's likely to be associated with every emotional state and center. Most people don't want to say, yes, what a good moment for hopeless despair. We're going to learn how to feel that together. I'm looking forward to feeling as hopeless as you are and as great despair, because, you know, under those conditions, there's a lot to be learned, and I'm really glad, looking forward to our chance to talk with you about it. Mostly, counselors want to try to avoid triggering that again. So, well, let's see how we can go back, and next time maybe I can do this and I'll do that, and they won't get into hopeless despair when we leave. So that's kind of not a rupture. We're trying to avoid the problem. We don't want to bring it up because we don't want to get back into that. You see how we get into a dysfunctional pattern ourselves there. At least I did sometimes. I don't know if you would. They go to something else. And usually you will find with borderlines that they'll either go to rage or sexual reactions to try to return to joy if they don't have some other way to do it. And so we begin to say, no, we can be glad to be together, even if you're feeling X, Y, or Z. And we try to help them shift an emotional dominance from the guard shack to the joyful identity, from the back of the brain to the front of the brain. So instead of operating out of their fears and problem solving, they begin to operate out of what is it like them to do. A totally meaningless concept to begin with for them. And even for us, it seems like totally meaningless. We would hardly know what to say it would be like them to do. Except the answer is, it would be like them to do whatever they're about to learn from us. Because they're about to duplicate our brain structure and what we do. It's an awesome responsibility, because they will actually duplicate our brain chemistry, our brain structures, our way of handling it, as what they will learn to do, what it's like to do, how it's like to be ourselves. That's the only way that their brain can actually do it. So they're going to be copying us. It's the only hope they have. And so one way of talking about the right orbital prefrontal cortex is, and we do this by dealing with their right orbital prefrontal cortex in right hemisphere to right hemisphere. One of the things that's been found to be classically the case with people who have problems with the right orbital prefrontal cortex is that they misinterpret faces. They look at sad faces and they will say they're angry. And so they will misread your interpretation, which makes the communication much harder than you would if you're dealing with an infant, because their brains are actually misreading the communication. So there's a distortion going into these communications very, very fast. So they look at something, they get into pain, and your face flashes sadness. And they go, why are you getting mad at me? Or they react with simple anger and they don't even bother to say it. And you go, well, why are you mad at me now? I was just trying to move close to you. Now you're getting all mad about it. Well, they've misread the communications. That's why I said it's much harder to deal with a distorted item than just trying to grow one that wasn't there at all. Somehow or another, in the middle of that, now you need to still get back to being glad to be together. So that if we're communicating this way and we start to feel mad, our expression is, you're making me mad. And their feeling will be, you're making me mad. If we start feeling afraid, we'll feel, they're scaring me. And they will be feeling it too, and they're thinking, you're scaring me. So every time you get into a discussion of who's making who feel what, you're in a lost conversation at this point, because both brains experience it simultaneously as though it was being caused by the other. The point of it is not who caused it, but how do you act like yourself in the presence of that feeling? Okay, so I feel afraid. Now what is it like me to do? Well, it's like me to be relational. I have Jesus in this. We're going to be glad to be together. We're going to bring healing to the event. Whatever it is like you to do is what you want to do then, rather than to decide who caused it. Right hemispheric memory really makes this work going on right now. So they might immediately, in a sense like of abandonment, be transported in a memory feeling to some time when some horrific, terrible abandonment happened in their lives, which is out of total proportion to what's going on in the moment. And so we realize we're having this enormous emotional event happening for what seems to us to be a non-reason. And they will say, we were doing it to them. Although we can look at it and go, there's no reason here that I'm doing this to you. How do we get then to deal with that? But the first thing they're going to do is blame you for it. That's the imputed causality. Say, you're making me feel this terrible. We're saying, it's probably a memory coming from someplace. You felt abandoned. What you did was you went screaming after somebody trying to hit them. They're going to come screaming after you trying to hit you. That's the tape of what they saw happening. It's less than endearing. I remember one woman sitting across the office from me, and she just got furious, started calling me names and screaming, yelling at me. I've never been and so insulted, humiliated all my life. And finally she looked at me and she said, "Don't you know when I do that I want to be close to you?" And I was shocked, and I just didn't know this stuff yet. No. No. And something in her left hemisphere kicked in and she said, "It doesn't work very well, huh?" That was a clue to me. I think that's the greatest gift anyone ever gave to me at that moment. It's like, hey, if that's the best you've got, no wonder we need to have a relationship here, because it really doesn't work very well. We need to learn a whole new way. Yes. Now, that is a rupture, a misattunement. She's sending me a message loud and clear, "I want to be close to you," by screaming and calling me all manner of obscenities. But I'm not tracking with it. That's what it means by misattunement. I missed the message. And so we have a rupture. Our relationship broke apart. I'm not with her anymore on this point. I don't say, "Oh, yeah, I'm sorry you're feeling so bad. I know you want me to be close to you right now." That's, of course, because I didn't get it. Now, how we repair that is going to be of the essence. See, that's what builds hope. That's what says, "Oh, I can understand you. We can get back together." And some of these ruptures actually happen. And other times they're just anticipated, because in the past when they've had this feeling, the person they've been with has broken relationships with them. So they may just simply anticipate that if they get mad at me, I'm going to kick them out and have nothing more to do with them. In actual fact, they get mad at me, nothing happens. But they don't know that, and so they react by anticipation just as though I was going to. And we run through the whole scene and they say, "Well, you kicked me out." Yeah, well, when was that? Well, I felt it, you know, it's real to me. And we're dealing with a memory that's intruded. This was anticipated. And so some of these realities, we're trying to say in our mind, okay, where was that coming from? Where does this fit? What part of their experience would we say that's where this one came from? And they usually happen at our worst. And during those times, it's important that you are able to tune back into what's going on with them. But what I'm trying to say to you is, if the rupture doesn't happen, they'll never learn how to make repairs. So don't look at these things as though something went wrong. It's you finally got your chance to work at it. When I worked as an electronic repairman, and in fact those poor guys with the sound system the other day, the problem with it is that something go wrong, but then it start working again. It's real easy to fix something if it just keeps not working. But you have to have it keep going wrong again so you can catch that problem. And so these ruptures are exactly what we're hoping for. Something will go wrong, we can catch that problem. We say, okay, now here we're here, this is exactly the thing we were waiting for. Something was going to go wrong in a relationship, now we'll show you how to put it back together. I'm really glad to be with you now. I'm just the person that you needed, because you don't know how to fix something like this. It's hopeless and awful for you, but we know how to fix some of these sorts of things. We know about forgiveness, we know about all kinds of healing, all sorts of potential. This is just when, you know, you just have come to the right place. Okay, now this, what we do that, let's see, when we repair things, it builds you to be perfect. And by the way, the best chance of someone going to sue you is if they have that kind of narcissism. They say, "You're the best thing that ever happened to me." Those are inevitably the ones that are most likely to sue you, because as soon as you prove not to be, they will punish you for having, not followed that role. So narcissism is the most dangerous aspect of all of this, also the most dangerous aspect in community. And so being able to work towards correcting narcissism is a very, very important thing to reduce the most dangerous aspect of all of this. Actual mutual regulation of these feelings is handled this following way. Here's a little procedure you run through, 7 steps. What the client does is... they induce the pain. They'll run their tapes. They're hoping that you will observe and keep track of all of those memories that are in there, because they're too upset and they don't know how to do it. So if you're here to help them resolve what went on in their life, well, when you're this intensely upset, what they're hoping is that you'll be able to, under these terrible conditions, track and say, "Oh, this is the present and that's the past, and I think this goes with that memory and that goes with that memory. I know what I'm doing, I'm thinking, and I know how to act like myself," which is what you signed up to do if you're going to be a counselor. And so they find this not a bit unusual that now that you actually got to the problem, you are going to continue doing what you said you were going to do. And they're very disappointed with you if you don't. Most of us at that point feel like, you know, you just violated my contract. You know, I was going to be nice and you were going to be nice and we were going to work this out nice. And this isn't nice. But they run their pathology for you, so have a look at this. It triggers, if you can handle this feeling, their brain tracks it real accurately and tries to do the same thing. And once you can show them how to act like this, they can begin to learn it. Now all you have to do is to repeat this about 300 or 400 times. And then they'll grow the circuit strong enough that they can do it on their own. They await for a return to joy, are glad to be together. And this is when we have to signal that to them. And if they don't get return to joy at the end, then the fire department gets called out, their systems get flooded with cortisol, and everything that happened on that day gets erased. And they just take out that new learning, they erase it, and they start over again. So it's essential to return to joy at the end of these learning tracks, so we say we're glad to be together. Otherwise, they're going to be pumping cortisol, and you just lost your lesson for the day. Obviously, I don't want to lose too many of these. They're hard work. So we want to get back to joy together. Now, the return to joy method. It's going to be handled by the right orbital prefrontal cortex. So your communication has to be in that kind of nonverbal way. When it takes over, the parts of their brain that think get shut off. The part of their brain that remembers what you said gets shut off. It's actually, you put it on the brain scan, it goes dark. Whoop, it's not there. It'll be back after the upset is over. So all of these agreements that you put, now next time you get mad and you get upset, you're going to do this and this and this and this, right? Okay, we're going to do that. Ooh, that's fine. All those verbal agreements, they're gone. They'll be back afterwards, but right now they're off. That part of the brain is actually shut down. So the people who say, and this is the one that kills me the most, you have somebody who's having real problems with this kind of borderline behavior with their husband and wife, and you say, well, let's go in and have some communication exercises. We'll learn how to talk and how to make agreements. We're going to deal with this. We're going to contract. We're going to contract between you and the pastor. We're going to do that. We're going to work this out. We're going to talk it over. Talking will get you absolutely no place when the emotion kicks in, because that part of the brain that did all the talking is literally shut off and won't be back till afterwards. And that, of course, what happens afterwards, they remember it, and everyone feels guilty and angry and upset and rejected. And, well, it's a great opportunity for lots of ruptures to be repaired, but that rarely happens when you're working on verbal communication. So don't do it. Lucked into a little bit of this, I think, maybe by the Holy Spirit. But when my brother and I used to fight, she used to sing a little song. Be ye kind to one another, be ye kind to everyone. And she'd hear my brother and I, voices getting kind of loud and raucous in the backyard, and we'd hear the singing in the kitchen. And it made us mad. But one of the effects that it had on me is that later on, when things began to go wrong in my sessions, the only thing I could remember to do was, well, at least I need to be kind to this person. And so it was really locked in there very deeply. It became one of the characteristics that people say to me every time that, you know, something has gone wrong. They will say to me afterwards, and it just amazes me because I hear it so repeatedly, well, why were you so kind to me? And I could say, well, because my mom sang. But it wouldn't make any sense to them. And so I just say, well, I guess it's just like me. And you recognized it, didn't you? Well, yes, I did. Well, then it must be like you to be kind under those circumstances too, because there's something kind about you there responding to something kind about me there. If you hadn't been kind at all, you wouldn't have recognized it. You wouldn't have had anything. So let's find that. I mean, we must both be kind persons. This is going to work out great. We're hopeful. They have kindness in them even under those upset circumstances. They could recognize and respond to it. We're calling out what God put in them. Wonderful stuff. Thanks, Mom. And then we could do this again about 100 times. Getting into any kind of feeling that was not, they don't have a return to joy, they'll punish you for. And whenever you practice this, it'll uncover whatever emotions you're not good at. They will also uncover by practicing this just how strong your joyful identity is. So if you stop acting like yourself, you'll pretty quickly be aware of it. And this is going to be a great chance for you to remediate for yourself any areas where you don't have return to joy or have a lack of joy strength yourself. So counselors, if you're getting into dealing with borderline, get into building joy and learning how to return to joy yourself in great, great fashion. I mean, you're going to have to be working on this systematically in every area of your life. Now, personally, from my perspective, why shouldn't we be working on it systematically in every area of our life regardless? Because this is, to me, just the essence of what life is about. So if anything, it's just a stimulation to do what it is that we're really called to do anyway. Now, they experience themselves as being sexually aroused. And they will attribute that to you. And so they say, you are making me feel sexually aroused right now. And you go, what? And this is very uncomfortable. Most of us don't know how to deal with it. When those issues are present, you have to have a very mature counselor who really knows what they're doing and how to act like themselves during times of sexual arousal. This is a very, very tough one. Now, it is not just simply safe enough to say, get a same-sex counselor, because a number of these people, in fact, a rather high percentage, were abused by the same-sex person. Women were sexually abused by their mother. I have a number of women who come to me, deal with me specifically because of that aspect of the abuse. They say, well, if I'm going to have to feel those feelings, at least I don't feel so perverted about it if there's a man in the room. And they're humiliated beyond belief that they'd have those feelings around me at all. But for them, it's actually more of a safeguard, because at least it's not as awful that they're afraid that something is happening with another woman again. So you can't really just say, you know, let's get the same sex here to do that with. But what you have to say is, if you don't have a really good idea who you are and high levels of sexual arousal, then you ought not to go this. And you want to know the test for that. Think what you did during your dating experience. And if you were able to live in a way that was pleasing to God during your dating experience and in other women and other men, then you'd probably say to yourself, I think I probably have a good idea. And if you're full of holes in that area, then you're going to go to the second thing, and that is, don't do it alone. And you have to have at least two people in the room. Now, we're about to go to why that's a good idea anyway. And that is because the bonds in our mind that we're remediating are probably three-face bonds. In other words, there aren't just two people in a bond. I think the way God designed our bond structure is to be a three-face bond, three faces in there. And the basic premise is you can't reconstruct a three-face bond with only two people in the room. It doesn't happen. You have to have at least two faces in the room additional to the person who you're helping if you're going to get a three-face bond structure recreated inside there. They have to see how do three people work together. Well, attached to what was going on with two other people. So, when my wife and I had a baby, and she begins to nurse and care for that baby, if I feel connected to that baby when my wife is nursing and caring for the baby, and I'm feeling warm, it's like, well, that's wonderful, isn't that great, and I'm feeling a part of it all, something, I have to be the third part of that connection in order to feel connected to it. People who don't have that feel that as soon as someone is out relating to someone else, they're disconnected from them. And so you find with borderlines that have only two faces working inside, that as soon as you take a call from somebody else, as soon as you're interested in someone else, if you just even mention your wife or husband, they feel terribly upset, jealous, left out, like, now you don't care about me at all, I'm completely disconnected from this. Why? Because there's no third face in that bond. If there's only two people that can be connected, there can't possibly be a third person that's a part of that relationship. And so there must be, for those of us who can do three at once, there has to be something in our cyber brain that will do that. Now, the scans have not come up with this yet, but that's also because they've not looked for it. They've just been working on the two faces. But I talked with Dr. Shore about it after one of his lectures, and he suggested that I write the theoretical paper about the subject, but I knew enough about myself to realize I'm never going to spend that much time in the library. So maybe one of you will be called to do that job. Now, if there are three faces, and from now on let's just assume that I'm right about this, and there are, if the third face is not joyful, you have a constantly destabilized emotional state. That is, if I get close to you, someone else is going to be mad about it. And you'll see this happening in counseling. He says, Well, what are they going to think if this? What's going to happen? What are they? And they are always upset at us. Or when you are together with someone else, they, and now become that third face, they're always upset with you. There's also the third face can attack. And in some family relationships, anytime any two people start getting close, one of the parents attacked them. And so they kept them from being bonded and close to other people. And so what they will do is anytime you start getting close to anyone else, they begin anticipating someone else is going to attack. So they want to just take you off by yourself where no one else can see you, and they're just going to have you all entirely to themselves. And if you get close to anybody else, they're just like a bandsaw coming at you to tear apart this thing which is happening and taking you away from them. That's the third phase. And you're all that I have. And that becomes the most difficult one. There's no way to remediate that with only two people in the room. You have to have a third person in order to say, well, if you're not with me, you're with them. And that's how basically you teach a child about it. Teaching the child to walk, mommy's holding the child and the child is looking at daddy. He said, go walk to daddy. Well, a child is not thinking, I'm walking away from mother, I'm being abandoned. They're looking at daddy and daddy's smiling, going, come here, come here, come here. And they walk to daddy and they look back at mommy and they're happy and they just get over there and it's not going back to mommy. They're always aware that going away is actually going towards. And so you become very comfortable with that. There's always a third face in this bond. If mommy's mad at me right now, it's okay, daddy will come in and take care of things for a minute till mom cools down. There's security in that three-way bond. If you look on the don't involve bonding in any sense, and secondly, a number of these require a three-face bond in order to correct. So the most difficult problems don't require one person in the room, they require two people in the room. They have to happen in some kind of a community. Now for us, as counselors, Jesus can be the third face. And when we come to the point where our counselee has such a strong relationship with Jesus in all of their parts and emotional states, that Jesus is that absent face. And so you ask him, where is Jesus with us right now? He's absent. Where is Jesus with us? He's the attacking face. He's mad at me. What is Jesus doing? He's thinking that it's terrible that I should be here sharing with you or taking all your time or taking you away from your other clients. There's always... So you have to have a third person there to do that for you. So the development problems that are... So you look at any of those problems, you say, this person is going to have to learn how to do this by virtue of a bond, and probably a three-way bond. So those of you who are actually practicing this in a community structure are probably in the best shape. This is really not a problem that ought to be dealt with so much in counselors' offices. But the problem with that is that most communities have no idea of how to return to joy or repair ruptures or do anything else. So you're looking for healthy, strong, emotionally mature people who can be a part of your fellowship and direct these kind of interactions. You're going to need them around you if you're going to deal with borderline kind of problems. So if no one else knows that this is the goal, begin to build those around yourself, because eventually it is how you built those around yourself that's going to provide an access for a person to learn to deal with it. Now, sometimes that simply isn't available. And in that case, you might realize that God is going to just make you person number two or three or six in the sequence. And that he's going to take a little part of you and incorporate that into the person. Then take a little part of somebody else and incorporate that in the person. Then he'll send them off to someplace else and incorporate some part of them into this person. And eventually, they will learn it just a piece at a time. How can we know what the divine wisdom is? How can we know how he's going to deal with all of us who are imperfect in our ways and our communities that are imperfect in our ways? But what we can do and really can take everywhere is the sense that we need to be glad to be together. That sense of joy as both the starting and the finishing end of all that we do is the essence of it. You see, we want to start in joy, we want to end in joy, and in the middle of it, we want to remember, no matter how bad this is, the goal is to be still glad to be together. And if I get overwhelmed, I'll just disconnect and remind myself that the first thing I want to do is to be glad to be together. And to have that as the definition of our family, not just our counseling, but also to bring it in as the definition of what we are as a church community. It can be very informative, even if you have 100 failures. Again, the repairing of failures is more significant to the process than keeping it everything right to begin with. So don't let it worry you if your community and family and others seem to fall apart or not handle all of this well. Repairing it is ultimately very important. And to do that, you have to be basically honest. Dallas Willard, some of you might know him, once defined humility this way: never pretend. And so we want to be together as a people who are glad to be together, but we never pretend. Well, now for resource information. There's this book here by Daniel Siegel, The Developing Mind, Towards the Neurobiology of Interpersonal Experience. It's available from Guilford Press in New York. Online, it's www.guilford.com. They also have an 800 number. And the book is about $27, $30, something like that. Expensive book. The developing to be the now the minimal standard of information on the brain for anyone who's counseling. So if you want to deal with any kind of counseling issues, this is kind of the starting place of what you need to know. It's readable. It's not readable like overnight. You just can't zip through it. You actually have to learn something as you're going along. But he's actually done a very nice job of putting the information basically that I'm giving you about how the brain works all laid out. He talks about the attachment patterns, how to come back from all of that. So anyone who's actually doing counseling that involves any kind of attachments ought to know this stuff. It has all the latest neurobiology. I've been in conferences as recently as 9 months ago with him and listened to him debate with the leading research neurologists in the world. And he's done a very, very good job. And for a neurologist and a secular one, he's also stayed pretty largely away from evolution and subjects like that. But where he has gone into that, you can just skip that section and go down to where he talks about the helpful stuff. So I think really it's worth reading, and you know, just making yourselves familiar. When you're done with this, you'll find that all the things that in your head that were swimming about understanding it today will largely be cleared up. If you're dealing with Christian community, I recommend The Red Dragon Cast Down, which is how do we do this in the context of a Christian community. If you're interested in what it looks like in maturity and growing up people in joy, raising children across the lifespan, I recommend Stages of a Man's Life. And if you want to know how we do this as a healing community, that's the life model, healing and growing from the living from the heart that Jesus gave you. And those ones are all on the book table. Okay, how much time do we have left? None? Bye. I'm over.